Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Night Talk Radio with host Colin Knight on the Terror Jam Radio Network.
In the days of perhaps, when all is dark, and there will be no daytime worries in your view, in the dead of night, expanding your mind to the greater world about you. In the dead of night, when the night winds howl, in the sacred hours of the castle walls, in the dead of night, when all is still, who will you be tonight?
Tonight's guest is Steve Nance, a Vietnam United States Air Force vet who held a top secret security clearance while working on electronic warfare projects and electronic countermeasure systems, both ground-based and airborne. One of Steve's many duties while serving his country, Steve was a fighter pilot debriefer in Vietnam and has heard first-hand accounts of reported unknowns by military flight personnel. For the last 35 years, Steve has been researching the subject of UFOs and alien abduction while personally involved in a multi-witnessed abduction which include aspects of missing time and distance. He has observed 3 multi-witness nocturnal UFO sightings and a daytime UFO sighting. As a civilian field investigator, he has interviewed sighting eyewitnesses and reported abductions throughout the Midwest. Steve has been featured and interviewed by some of the most renowned investigating ufologists in the field. He has appeared on many Midwestern radio and television talk shows, fielded questions from their listening and viewing audience. Steve continues to fly and has logged several hundred hours of flight time during his civilian UFO investigations. Steve Nance, next on Night Talk. Night Talk Radio, ladies and gentlemen, the purveyor of paranormal pontification, Colin Knight.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of Night Talk Radio. It is Sunday, August the 12th, 2012, 22 degrees Celsius in the great city of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. That's about 72 degrees Fahrenheit for our American listeners. Weekly shout-outs to some of our regular listeners, to the BC Dreamcatcher. Keep believing, never surrender. Look forward to seeing you again soon. And to the Southeast Brickies, much better half. Coffee is definitely a possibility. Make contact, Beth. And to our latest listeners from the Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada area, glad you are tuned in. I shall be in your region in the next couple of weeks, and I do think we should do a coffee clutch. What do you think? To our regular listener, the Calgary Scottish Lass, we continue to remind you to find time for you and remember that your needs are paramount to the harmony of life. Very special shout-out to Janice from Minnesota, who listens weekly to the Terror Chat Net, both the VOCR show and here on Night Talk. Janice is recovering from breast cancer, and the outcome looks absolutely fantastic. Janice, you are in our thoughts. And Jack from Melbourne, Australia, thanks for the UFO info, Jack. We shall follow up on your message next week and see what we can arrange, and thanks for your contact. And a special shout-out to my good friend Ed Fleming, who will be on the show in the next few weeks. Ed Fleming, thank you very much, sir. You saved my bacon. And as the Summer Olympics close in London, England, and the world comes together to sing Imagine by John Lennon, it is a reminder that we are all in this together. We are one world united, at least for 16 days of this year. Next month, we shall be touching base with Andy Lloyd in the UK as we update the Planet X and the Mars exploration, as well as some impressive UFO sightings over the British countryside. We ask that you watch the listings for that. Tonight, Steve Nance, UFO investigator, Vietnam vet, an avid UFOologist, and a fabulous investigator. Next, all of that. just for you, in the Night Zone. Good evening, Steve. Welcome to Night Talk.
Good evening, Alan.
There we go. Got you now.
Okay. Good evening, Colin. How are you this evening?
Excellent, Steve. Thank you for jumping in at a last-minute notice. For our listeners, we did have a guest cancellation at the last minute, and Steve was up on the list for contact and to be a guest at a future time. And Steve graciously stepped forward into the breach. And for that, Steve, we truly appreciate it.
Well, Colin, I absolutely appreciate the opportunity. It's my pleasure.
And Steve, so you're the coordinator of MAAR, M-A-A-R. What exactly is that?
Yes, I'm the co-director of MAAR, which stands for Malevolent Alien Abduction Research. It's a website that myself and my co-director, Colleen Johnston, and I have been doing since 2003. And we have been studying alien abduction and the implications of these alleged abductions. And it has been a very good experience and mind-opening, to be sure.
Now, did your Air Force experience, did that kind of put you on track for your last 30 years of civilian UFO investigation?
Well, absolutely. Now, let me start off and give you a brief synopsis of my history and as an observer. It started when I was in high school. I was a member of the Civil Air Patrol. And at that time, we were asked to remember and recognize silhouettes of domestic and foreign aircraft.
Right.
So it gave me a pretty good understanding of what to look for when I'm looking in the sky. And then also I was an amateur rocket enthusiast and launched several rockets that my father and I had built when I was 16, 17, 18 years old.
Right.
And from that point, I went into the Air Force. I received a top secret security clearance for my work to be done in electronic warfare. And during that time, I was privy to a lot of information about some of the aircraft that we had flying. And after that, I was a firefighter for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I was a firefighter during this period of time that my wife and I encountered an object in Colorado on October 6, 1977. And as a firefighter, I was trained because I volunteered as a United States Weather Bureau, which is now NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric
right.
Agency. And at that time, I was a spotter for stormy weather, for tornadoes, and severe weather. And so I had my experience there. I have been a private pilot since 1969, and I've logged several hundred hours of flight time. Although I must be candid and tell you that I've never seen the UFO while flying, unlike Kenneth Arnold.
Right.
I've never seen that. But I do believe that these qualifications over the years have made me a keen observer and have qualified me as such to you know, be able to describe the things that I've seen.
You've had the experience and training to get the chaff away from the wheat, so to speak, by identifying silhouettes of planes and anomalies. Plus, your Air Force experience that has put you in good stead as a UFO investigator. Am I right?
That is correct.
Yeah. In 1977, you mentioned October the 6th, 1977. You saw something. You and your wife saw something. First of all, let's kind of lay out the scene. What kind of a day was it? Was it overcast, sunny night? What were we looking at here?
We're looking at altitude about 12,000 feet in the Colorado Rockies. It was perfectly clear, no moon, and it was perfectly clear evening. It was a little chilly outside because, you know, even in the summertime or even during that time of the year, at the higher elevations, it starts getting a little chilly at night.
Right.
So we're riding along with our car windows up when this occurred.
Okay, so what exactly did you see, Steve?
Well, in the early morning hours of October the 6th, 1977, while driving through the remoteness of the Colorado Rocky Mountains, my wife and I were unwittingly confronted by a close proximity UFO. We know beyond a doubt, due to corroborating and circumstantial evidence to substantiate this incident, that we had actually experienced this UFO encounter. And due to the bizarreness of the incident involving missing time and missing distance, we can only assume that there is a very strong likelihood that we were also abducted by this unknown force from the dark night sky.
Okay.
In 1977, during the last 2 weeks of the month, in September, my wife and I, Eileen, as I mentioned, I was a firefighter, professional firefighter, and my wife, who was a health insurance claims adjuster, and myself, as I said, had taken our annual vacation time to drive to Southern California to visit a good friend, Benny Sargent, and his wife and family near Camp Pendleton, California.
Mm-hmm.
He had been stationed at Pendleton for just a little bit over a year, and my wife and I had known him and his family when he was going to school via the military in Kansas City, which is where I'm from and where my wife and I were living at that time. And although we lived amongst many of the America's greatest entertainment attractions, we have never taken the opportunity to explore them. But we did with Larry Crickle was his name, and with his wife and his 7-year-old son. We had scheduled some of his vacation time to correspond with our visit so that we could all see the sights together.
Right. Yeah.
Now, neither Eileen nor I had ever spent much time on the West Coast, and for two wonderful weeks, we were able to enjoy most of the Southern California tourist spots with our dear friends. And however, of course, most good things must come to an end. And on the morning of October the 4th, we bid a fond farewell to our friends as we got to our car for the return trip home to Kansas City. We drove east for several hours until we reached Las Vegas. It was early evening, and we had decided to stop for a room in order to get a good night's rest.
Right.
The next morning, we slept in, then we got up and around and shaved and left the hotel. We didn't leave our room almost until checkout time. We ate one of those terrific Las Vegas breakfasts. And
uh-huh.
If you've ever been to Las Vegas, you should know what I'm talking about.
Number of times.
And had the waitress fill our thermos bottle with hot coffee, and feeling completely refreshed and invigorated, we jumped into our car to resume our homeward journey at around noon on the 5th of October. We've been driving pretty steadily since our departure from Las Vegas, stopping over to eat, refill our thermos bottle, and to occasionally stretch our legs.
Right. Now you're heading east, am I correct?
That is correct, on Highway 50.
Right.
And the weather has been absolutely gorgeous, and we were thoroughly enjoying the beautiful sights as we drove along on our merry way. And as night fell, we left Utah and crossed into Colorado. I remember how disappointed we were that we would not be traveling through Colorado in the daytime to view the marvelous and majestic scenery that that state has to offer. But we had been on the road for a good part of the day,
right,
and for most of the evening. We had planned to stop at Salida, Colorado, for a night's lodging before attempting to travel from the lake to our trip to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
We'd also planned to make a portion of the next day to try out some road paths that we had purchased in Kansas City before we left for vacation. And I had even purchased a how-to book that was entitled Painted for Gold in the Colorado Rockies. There were several places near Santa Colorado that the book recommended that we stop at, including one spot in the nearby mountains that my family and I had vacationed at many times when I was a child. Eileen and I had also camped out there and fished there on several occasions. There are many old abandoned gold mines in that area, and we thought that it might be a lot of fun to try to pan for gold in some of the streams that ran near them. Eileen had been sleeping for several miles, and I amused myself by monitoring my CB radio as we drove eastbound along Highway 50. I started to hear a lot of chatter on the CB from truckers who were commenting about vast herds of deer that were congregating on and around 50 Highway near Gunnison, Colorado, near Blue Mesa Reservoir. Just a few miles west of Gunnison, the deer started appearing along the highway. I had to slow the car down several times and almost came to a complete stop at times to let some of the deer cross the road.
Uh-huh.
By this time, many people were on CB radio talking about the amazing number of animals that were being seen there.
Now,
after passing through Gunnison, Colorado, westbound truckers were starting to warn me about deer that were along the highway on the eastern slope of the Continental Divide, just east of Monarch Pass.
Right.
I reciprocated by warning them about the huge numbers of deer we had encountered west of Gunnison, and as the car continued eastbound on Highway 50, I approached the base of the western slope of the mountain range that makes up the Continental Divide. At that time, I woke up my wife, Eileen, and asked her to help me watch for deer on the road that the truckers had been reporting. She got up and poured us a cup of coffee from the thermos bottle and scolded me for not waking her earlier to see the deer near Denison.
Uh-huh.
I told her that from the sounds of things, she would be able to see plenty of deer as we traveled over the Continental Divide and eastbound towards from Monarch Pass towards Salida, Colorado. We started up the western slope of the mountains toward Monarch Pass, keeping our eyes peeled for deer. The trip up the western mountainside had not revealed a single deer, and I had been talking with a westbound trucker on my CB who was driving up the eastern mountain slope. We exchanged information regarding the deer situation, and he assured us that they were still quite active and moving back and forth across the highway on the eastern side of the mountains.
Now, how far from Vegas were you by this time, Steve?
From Vegas?
Yeah.
About 300 miles.
300 miles. So,
yeah.
So you were well out of the Area 51 zone.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. And I'd been talking with a westbound trucker who was driving up the eastern mountain slopes, as I mentioned, and we exchanged information regarding the deer situation, and he assured us that they're still quite active and quite a few deer moving back and forth across the highway on the eastern side of the mountain. The truck driver and I were talking about our respective destinations as we simultaneously arrived at the summit of Monarch Pass, which is around 11,312 feet or so above sea level. As our vehicle passed in the night with the truck, we flashed our headlights at one another, and I then asked the truck driver if he could give me a time check. My wife Eileen was wearing a wristwatch at the time, but he was such a likable sounding fellow and character that I just felt like chatting with him a little longer, doing what we used to call ratchet jawing.
Yeah.
He told us that it was about 1:30 a.m. As a matter of fact, he told us it was exactly 1:30 a.m., and after glancing at her watch, my wife Eileen confirmed that time of 1:30. The trucker and I, in exchanged mutual wishes for a safe journey, and I watched him in the rearview mirror as the taillights of his 18-wheeler disappeared from view over the western side of the mountain. Now, we began our descent down the eastern side of the Continental Divide from Monarch Pass. For the next 2 or 3 miles, the highway was loaded with hairpin curves that were aptly denoted by signs of red caution, dangerous curves ahead.
Right.
And warning, slow to 15 miles per hour. And Arnie and I had both commented about how crystal clear the sky was at that altitude and how bright the stars seemed. They seemed to twinkle and sparkle with exceptional brightness, and I had completed the last of the series of hairpin curves and had entered a part of the highway that runs pretty much straight down the side of the mountain to Salida, Colorado. And just as I entered the straightaway portion of the highway, several deer walked out in front of the car from the right shoulder of the road, and I was still going quite slow from the last curve that I had just negotiated, and easily brought the car to a crawl. The deer were in no hurry as they slowly sauntered along in single file fashion in front of the car, crossing the highway from the right to the left. I took the automatic transmission out of drive, placed it into neutral, and let the car's engine idle. The car was headed downhill, and I could now govern the car's speed going forward with just the brakes.
Right.
The car was now inching forward at less than 1 mile per hour, and we had no idea how large this herd of deer was. Eileen and I sat there watching as a line of deer appeared out of the darkness on the right, walked in front of the car, and through the illumination of my car's headlights, not more than just 15 feet away from the car, then disappeared into the darkness off to the left-hand side of the highway.
So it's about 2:30 in the morning now?
It's actually probably more like 1:35, 1:40, something along there.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. And the deer were just kind of, like I said, sauntering along. We've been watching this procession of deer for under a minute when suddenly the CB radio that I had on started getting a lot of static on it and breaking up. There was nobody talking on it, but there was a lot of static indicating that there was some kind of interference.
Just high squelch, as we used to call it in CB in 1977. A lot of high squelch.
Yeah. Absolutely, a lot of high squelch. And so I reached down, turned it off. It was pretty noisy, and it was actually starting to annoy me a little bit.
So how long after you first started to hear the static and the squelch on the CB, how long after that did you spot whatever it was in the sky?
Well, as soon as I turned off the CB radio, a blinding, intense white light appeared. The deer were instantly startled by this intense light and immediately bolted off the highway, from the highway, in bounding and jumping motions. They were spooked. White tailed deer, one of the things they are notorious for is flagging when they feel like they're in danger.
Yep, their tail goes up, the white spot. Yep.
Exactly. And this intensely white light seemed to enhance those deer tails as they went off into the darkness.
Right.
And it was just as if we were surrounded and completely bathed in this pure white light. It's very, very hard for me to describe. It was more than just a brightly shining light. It was as if the car had become, if the light had become part of our environment, both inside and outside the car.
Right.
I heard a rap. Yes, go ahead, please.
Well, sorry. Were you anywhere close to an Air Force base? Colorado have a number of Air Force bases, I believe.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the things that flashed through my mind, my mind raced to really justify where this intense white light could be coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I also, when I was in the Air Force, worked at Strategic Air Command Headquarters in Omaha, at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. And my first thought was that we were being had come under attack, nuclear attack. And the reason I thought about that is because U.S. Air Force Cheyenne Mountain and NORAD headquarters
right.
was not too far as a crow flies from that particular area. And the only thing I could think of at the time was that it had to be a new thermonuclear detonation. I'm not thinking, oh, great, here we go on vacation, and World War III is working out, and it would be the only thing that I could think of that would cause and generate such a blinding flash of light with that kind of lasting intensity, anyway. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, and I literally sat there waiting for the bomb shockwave to take us, but it never came, and at this point, I thought, well, maybe we're looking at some kind of a meteorological or an astronomical event.
Right.
We were at a very high altitude, around 10,000 feet at that point, and I thought that it might have been being caused by a meteorite with a fiery entry to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And at that altitude made it more more bright. And then I thought to myself, gosh, what can this be? At this point, I estimated that 5 or 6 seconds had elapsed from the time the light had first burst upon us.
Right.
And I thought how odd it was that this intense white light was not causing my eyes to squint, and was not producing any noticeable discomfort to my vision.
Right.
However, I instinctively threw my right hand up to shield my eyes so that I could try to see just what in the heck was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to look over the hood of the car, and as my hand passed in front of my eyes, I was horrified to noticed that it looked like I was viewing an X-ray picture.
Really?
The
light was that intense. Now, did you have a direction where this light was coming from, or was it just all-encompassing at this point in time?
Well, judging from the shadows of those few trees, because we are just right at timber line, so the trees are fairly sparse. And but judging from the shadows off the boulders that were being illuminated near the car, I could judge that it was probably to up and to the left rear of the automobile.
Okay.
So it to me had to be coming from above. To me, it had to be airborne. And like I said, the skin on my hand looked translucent, and I could see the bones, cartilage, and blood vessels within it.
And no noise at this time. You didn't hear anything.
No, none whatsoever.
Other than the bright light was the only indication that you were not alone.
Exactly.
Okay. Hold on to that thought, Steve. We're going to take a break at the bottom of the hour. And when we come back, we'll get into this, what on earth this thing was. How's that?
It sounds great, Colin.
Hang in there.
The Kepler satellite has identified 2,000 planets orbiting other star systems. So tonight, when you look at the night sky, realize that somebody could be looking back at you. Now, if there is a life form out there, they could be literally millions of years ahead of us. The universe is 13.7 billion years old, so a million years is nothing compared to the age of the universe. And for the most part, I think they're going to be friendly. But if they are hostile, it would be like Bambi meeting Godzilla if we ever had to fight them.
You're listening to Night Talk Radio on TerraChat Radio Network.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Well, realize that if they're that advanced, they can reach the Earth from a distant star. They are already thousands of years ahead of us in technology. And we would present no military challenge to such an advanced civilization. Now realize, for the most part, there are lots of uninhabited planets with resources on them. So if they can reach the Earth, they can certainly reach other planets that are uninhabited. So for the most part, I think they're going to leave us alone. But if one of them is hostile, watch out. We would be a pushover for them. Forget all the Hollywood movies.
347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
And tonight we have with us Steve Nance. We're talking about a first-person abductee, something that happened to Steve and his wife Arlene in 1977, October the 6th, 1977. Now, just to recap, Steve, something, a bright light on the east slope of the Continental Divide, shining down on your vehicle. You checked your eyes to try and cover your eyes to look ahead, and you noticed how translucent your skin was. And this is all happening in about 5-10 seconds of this light appearing. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So what happens next?
Well, at that point, after I had raised my hand up and seen what looked like an X-ray photo of it, right. I was getting ready to turn my head to the right to look at my wife, Eileen, and suddenly the light was gone and had been replaced by an eerie green glow. Excuse me. All of a sudden, I felt drained, dazed and very lethargic, as if I had just awakened from an exceptionally heavy sleep, or as if I were just coming out from under anesthesia of some kind.
Right.
My arms and legs felt numb and paralyzed. I couldn't move my head from left to right or up and down, but I could move my eyes from side to side. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The car seemed to be several feet above the highway and descending. Mm-hmm. to the road, and the trees along both sides of the car were shimmering as if they were mirages being produced by waves of heat on a hot summer day. You know how that is.
Right. Is the vehicle moving at this point in time?
Yes, it is.
You don't have any problems electronically with the vehicle? It's behaving itself? Everything's working okay as far as you can tell? You already have your speed up, so...
At that point, I really didn't know that because, as I said, I felt, paralyzed and numbed. And anyway, the road and the trees were on both sides of the cars were kind of an indication that the car was slowly moving forward through the air. Out of the corners, as I said, I could look out of the corners of my eyes, and I could see tree branches as I looked off to the left-hand side of the car, moving back and up past the side windows, to indicate that the car indeed was descending and moving, barely moving forward.
Right. So your vehicle had been lifted somehow, or it appeared that your vehicle was moving but not on the highway?
At this point I was still pretty much in the dark. We both were. My heart was racing like a motorboat. I had adrenaline really pumping. I don't mind telling you, I was afraid because this was all completely strange to me. And with no noticeable jolt to indicate contact with the pavement, the car was back on the highway and moving down the road. As I said, 5 to 10 miles per hour, I would guesstimate. And it was at that instant that I felt like my body, as I said, had been released from its immobilized state. At this point, I could once again feel my hands upon the car steering wheel, which I thought was very interesting because my right hand had just been in front of my face, and I don't recall moving it back onto the steering wheel. Everything outside the car was still being bathed in this eerie green fluorescent glow, much like the glow you would get off of a green neon light.
Gotcha.
And very, very incandescent. And as my eyes looked through the windshield, a glowing green object, chartreuse, like I said, in color, slowly appeared from over the top of the car, and the object looked exactly like a brightly illuminated green neon donut or overly inflated inner tube tire. So I estimate that the object was a couple hundred feet or so above, and that it was between 40 to 50 foot in diameter. As the object came into my total view, 7 blue pulsing flames appeared along the circumference of its trailing edge and were equally spaced pretty much along a 180-degree arc on the object. The object moved from over the top of the car and proceeded down the road above and in front of us. Then it suddenly banked sharply to the left. Its blue flames were simultaneously flashing on and off in perfect unison that I estimate to be between 8 to 10 pulses per second, much like the effect of a strobe light. Mm-hmm. And as the object moved through the sky, it left in its wake a trail of 7 spindly-looking green lines that were actually trailing directly behind these 7 pulsating blue flames.
So, would you say they look like tracer marks, like visual tracer lights as it's moving away?
Well, they looked like they had been expulsed from these flames. They were right behind these 7 blue flames that were flashing on and off, like I said, in a strobing-like manner. And I believe these lines were actually a byproduct of the optics propulsion system. I can't say whether these lines were actually glowing or were being illuminated by the reflection of the object's own brilliance. The lines are broken for some distance as they traveled behind the object. However, as the lines trailed further away from the object, they began to break up and tumble. Then they started dissipating and eventually seemed to implode in upon each other. This whole object was leaving behind in its wake an envelope that this was all contained in. The UFO made no sounds as it gathered airspeed. Now, as I said, the windows in the car were up.
Right.
And it kind of sloughed through the atmosphere as it moved forward. That was exactly the width of the UFO's diameter. The object produced a trailing on the rope, as I said, that was about 4 to 5 times longer in length than its own diameter, approximately 200 to 500 feet in length.
Right. Now, with this trail, being familiar with aircraft and the spotting of aircraft, was this a powered turbulence kind of wake, or was this just the presence of this massive object moving that had created this envelope behind it?
No, I believe it actually was contained within this envelope going through our atmosphere.
Okay, alrighty. Okay, so how much time had passed from when the white light hit you and you're watching this thing bank to the left? How much time do you figure had passed in your mind time? Not the time on your watch, but in your mind.
Exactly. This is most perplexing because from the time the light went on, at the top of Monarch Pass, like I said, a couple of miles from the top of it going down the eastern side of the slope, and from the time that the UFO came out from over the top of the car and banked up a mountain ridge, to the left of a mountain ridge, and then it slammed into a mountainside. The actual time seemed consciously to be in order of anywhere from 10 to 12 seconds.
Wow, that fast.
Yeah.
That fast. Now, how long was it on the journey before you realized that the time factor, according to your watch, was much longer?
Well, my wife and I had watched this object. She was watching it too, of course, unbeknownst to me, because, like I said, it all happened kind of fast.
Right.
As soon as the UFO disappeared in a blinding flash of sparks, I would say at that point is the first opportunity I had to actually talk with my wife after the UFO had disappeared.
Right.
At this point, I turned to her, and for the first time since all the confusion started, and I shouted, "Hey, did you see that?" And yes, she replied, and then she immediately asked, "What was it?" And I said, "Well, I think it was a UFO." I slowed the car down, pulled onto the right shoulder of the highway and stopped the car.
Mm-hmm.
Then I turned the headlights and the ignition key off because they had still been on.
All right.
As I rolled my window down, Eileen quickly asked in a very demanding voice, "Why are we stopping?" And I said, "Well, it didn't go over the Continental Divide, so it must have landed."
Mm-hmm.
"And I'd really like to get a closer look at it." And at that point, in the most fearful voice I'd ever heard my wife speak in the 35 years we'd been married, she said, "Oh my God, please." She was begging me and sobbing, "Let's get out of here. we don't know what's happened to us,
right.
And I'm really afraid.
She was
please
terrified.
Please let's go, is what she asked. And, and her pleading voice literally jarred me back into reality.
Right.
I could hear my heart pounding in my ears.
Uh-huh.
And we sat there motionless for a moment. We sat looking into each other's eyes, and it was a very strange time. There was a strange and kind of eerie silence as we sat there inside the car.
Right. So if this UFO did not clear the continental divide, you were fairly convinced that it had either landed somewhere or crashed.
Well, let me explain something to you. This is very, very odd,
mm-hmm.
most bizarre, and that is where the car stopped was directly across from a county road that accesses a reservoir located at the end of a 21-mile unapproved roadway that takes a couple hours just to get to it because you have to traverse this road in a very, very slow fashion because of all the boulders and things like that. It was an area that my father had first taken us to when I was 10 years old in 1956, when we were kids, when I was a kid. And our family had vacationed there. We loved the place. Our family had vacationed there literally for years after that, sometimes twice a year.
Right.
And we went fishing there and camping. And it's a gorgeous place, Colin. It's, you know how Rocky Mountains can be so majestic.
Mm-hmm.
And this place was just... absolutely filled with majesty, and this is near Maysville, Colorado, and I knew this, and my wife and I had been there also since our marriage several times to camp and fish, and so I knew this area as well as she did as well. Probably almost as well or better than some of the locals knew it.
Right.
Nobody was hardly ever up there. Every time my family would go up, or every time that Eileen and I would go up there, and it was, like I said, 21 miles, it's kind of a remote place.
Uh-huh.
And
so you were familiar with the area, so
yeah.
you knew that this object, whatever it was, had not cleared the Rockies, the Continental Divide.
Absolutely.
And,
there's a box hanging there.
You believed it was somewhere close to ground?
Yeah, I believe it had landed or crashed.
Right.
And at that point, my wife and I decided to try to get something to eat. She told me, I just want to be around people.
Right.
It was right at that time that I asked her what her watch read, and she said it's 2:35.
Wow.
That would be about an hour, almost right at an hour, since we had gotten the time check from the trucker at 1:30, mm-hmm. which just seems as... just like a few minutes ago,
right.
instead of an hour. And also, something else had dawned on me, and that was the mountain valley that the UFO had flown up leads to this reservoir campground,
uh-huh.
and that I told you I was very familiar with.
Right.
She said it looked like it exploded to me, is what she said, and... like she said, I put the car in reverse and turned across Highway 50 and started north up this unapproved road. And she asked me what I was doing, and in a frightened voice, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm going to go up there and check it out." And she pleaded with me, as I said, not to do that. And then I realized, well, gosh, she was right. Actually, we didn't know what had happened to us. And we just wanted, and I'm like her, we just wanted to get sex to some people.
Right.
And maybe get a bite to eat and rest and so forth.
So after 35 years of marriage, when she said, no, I want to be around people, as a good husband, you did exactly what she requested.
Well, I learned quick.
God bless you. That's how your marriage has lasted, Steve. That's what it is.
Yes,
that's exactly
right.
How it is.
Well, unfortunately, she was killed and involved in a fatal car accident in Phoenix, Arizona in 2004, so I lost
I am so sorry to hear that. But I'm sure she's looking down on you with as much love and smile as she had when she was alive. Now,
absolutely.
So you have an unresolved issue where this thing has gone down either willingly or unwillingly. You know it's out there, yet you have conceded to head forward to get close to more human beings. Now, after this event, did you experience, were there any marks on your body? Did you experience any physiological changes at all?
Well, like I said, we both felt extremely fatigued.
Right.
Just suddenly, we hadn't felt that way prior to this, what seemed like to be a 10 to 12 second event.
Right.
And we decided, you know, like I said, to stop and do that. Now, there was a 24-hour truck stop along Highway 50 there in Salida that I had known of, that my family and I used to go down to, and it was open all hours of the day and night, 24/7. And however, when we got to the truck stop, it was closed. So we decided to go ahead and go down into Salida proper and see if we could find anything in the downtown area of Salida, like, you know, a restaurant or a cafe,
right,
or something of this nature. As we went down to the town square of Salida, we noticed a patrol car with two policemen sitting in it on the, that would be the west side of the town square.
Mm-hmm.
So I told Eileen that I was going to turn around and ask the policemen that we saw if they knew of any nearby restaurants that were open, and I went around the block and pulled up alongside the patrol car. The streets are totally empty. There wasn't another soul I could see around. And
right,
for the exception of our two vehicles, I turned the car's interior light on and asked my wife to roll a window down. The police officer behind the wheel of the car did the same with his window.
Uh-huh.
What transpired next is absolutely kind of amazing, and I told the officers that we've been driving for a while and that we'd probably go to the truck stop and sleep in the car until the restaurant opened, because they said, well, now it's the close at midnight and doesn't open until 6 a.m. So
right,
somehow I felt better telling them that we'd be there, and I showed them my badge and my ID, firefighter's ID, and one of the officers said, well, you know, we've got no problem with you doing that. Just make sure your doors are locked and don't go to sleep with your engine running.
Right.
And he said that that they regularly patrol the area during the evening, and that they would, when they go by, they would check to make sure we were okay.
Right.
And I also appreciated that very much. But and as we were getting ready to leave, I was getting ready to have, you know, ask my wife to roll the window back up and put the car in drive. And I don't know why I did, but I happened to mention, by the way, I told the one officer sitting behind the driver's seat,
mm-hmm,
I said, this may sound silly, but I think we were chased by a UFO up near Monarch Pass not more than 30 minutes ago. And the policemen looked at each other and chuckled. And I thought to myself, well, why the heck are these guys laughing about this? And
right.
Then the officer behind the wheel looked at us and said, well, welcome to the club. They've been seeing these things or these UFOs around here for the past 2 or 3 weeks.
Huh.
And that isn't really the response that we were wanting to hear, you know.
Right.
He made it sound so, as a matter of factly, frankly, we were both quite startled by his answer. And we thanked him and drove off down the street. And when we arrived at the truck stop, I pulled the car into the parking lot and shut the engine off. And I already retrieved a couple of pillows for the back seat, and we reclined our seats back to try to get some sleep before the restaurant opened.
Right.
Eileen laid back, and she said at that time, she said, you know, your eyes are really bloodshot. And I gazed into her eyes, you know, and mm-hmm. I said, well, wow, your eyes are pretty messed up too, you know. A lot of bloodshot as well. And
you hadn't really been on the road that long.
No, relatively. Well, we had stopped too, as I mentioned, and mm-hmm. You know, get a bite to eat every now and then, throw them, stretch your legs, etc.
Right.
So I mean, we really didn't feel tired at all until after this incident. We both felt, like I said, extremely fatigued, and it was a very strange ordeal,
right.
And after when I said that about her eyes, and after I, you know, looked in the rearview mirror and looked for myself, and I'm like, God, you know, they look like road maps, you know.
Right.
So she laid back and she went to sleep immediately, and I had laid back, and as I reclined the seat back, I felt a pain in the rear of my left arm as it inadvertently hit the metal part of the shoulder harness and of the seat belt. And I noticed pain there. So anyway, I didn't think much about it, and I laid back and I went to sleep. And the first thing I know, I'm hearing car doors shutting and mm-hmm. hearing traffic outside the car, and it's 6 a.m., and people are starting to come into this truck stop.
Right.
And anyway, we went inside and had something to eat. We felt good to be around people again, and we went into the restrooms and washed our faces and hands, and we had the waitress fill our thermos bottle to it and fill it up with coffee, and we felt somewhat refreshed, and so we went ahead and left, and I told Eileen when we got out of the car, I said, well, I told you I was going to go up there in the morning on this flight.
I knew you would. I tell you what, Steve, hold on to it there. We're coming up to the top of the hour. Just notify all the stations down the line. We're going to go 30 minutes over because this story is about to cook. Steve, hang in there, and we'll be back with you in just a couple of seconds, okay?
Okay.
You're listening to Night Talk Radio on the Terror Chat Radio Network.
There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, code-named Mavis, with John Hogue.
According to Genesis, Eden, or Eden, is where Adam was created from dust and Eve from one of his ribs. Others, however, have a more high-tech version of how human life began.
it is a real phenomenon. And there's quite a few of us, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 6 years or so. But slowly it's leaked out.
347-324-3287, 347-324-3287, and we remind our listeners of the archived shows, 3 years of fabulous interviews of some amazing guests. Come to the blog, nighttalkradio.com. 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287. Things that go bump in the night. To contact the show by email, terrorchat2012@gmail.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
In the dead of night, when all is dark, and all your daytime worries engulf you, in the dead of night, expanding your mind to the greater world about you. In the dead of night, when the night winds howl in the sacred halls of the castle walls. In the dead of night, when all is still, who will you be tonight?
This is Night Talk Radio on the Terror Chat Radio Network.
And so we have with us Steve Nance, first person abductee, UFO investigator, Vietnam vet, Air Force personnel, high security clearance. And so, Steve, you're all fed, you've had your coffee, I presume that you are well rested by this time. You have you've got your faculties all back in order, am I correct?
That's right, Colin.
Okay, so your wife obviously knew what kind of a person you were and that you weren't going to let this go. So,
actually, as I said before, it just so happens that at that very spot that we saw the UFO go up the mountain range, ridge, and disappear or crash or land or whatever, had planned and were carrying two glue pens in the trunk of the car that we had planned on stopping there for the day before continuing back to Kansas City to pay them for some gold, which we'd done before in the past. And, you know, we just found a few flecks here and there.
Right.
We never found another load or nugget or anything like that. It was just kind of fun. She said, well, you know, she asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, well, you know, if you don't mind, I thought that we'd try to go up to the reservoir and then work the stream coming back down with our looking for gold. Mm-hmm. And
but in the back of your mind, you're thinking about this UFO.
Absolutely.
Right.
As a matter of fact, Eileen said, I knew it. So you think that thing is still up there, huh?
Good
thing. And I told her, I said, well, I really don't know what to think, honey. But I didn't see it going with a divide up there because it's a box canyon type of setup. And it didn't come back down the valley. So those are the only two ways out of that area by air.
Right.
And she said, let I mother we were both pretty scared last night, and if you would really rather not go up there, then I would understand. And I told her, I said, look, we bought these gold pans, we plan on stopping there anyway, so let's do that, take a break before we head on back to the last lake.
Steve, you're a Vietnam vet. You're not gonna drive away from this and not put it to rest. So,
exactly.
what did you find?
Okay, we went up this very rough road. As I said, it was about 21 miles to this remote reservoir. The name of which I really don't want to divulge at this time because I have a research team. All the people you mentioned at the start of the show,
right.
Mr. Ed Fleming,
yeah.
With his UFO organization, and also a Mr. Terry Rowe, who is the director of Kansas Paranormal Society,
right.
And they're going to go up there with me in this next month, coming month.
Excellent.
So I really wanted to divulge.
Good. Exactly. Let's keep that secret. But just so you know, Steve, Ed Fleming from FTT UFO, he is down in our virtual studio listening to the show with us. So,
Hi, Ed.
So he's right there listening along. You're in this area, and your wife thinks you're panning for gold, but in the back of your mind, you're panning for a UFO.
Well, you know, I told her we go up there, check out that area, and then we work our way back down, panning for gold. And so, anyway, we went up there, and it was very, very strange because when we got to this reservoir, there were several men up there at that location. And they were fanned out, 12 to 14 men.
Civilians?
I'm sorry?
Civilians?
Well, I'm not sure. They looked like civilians. They had longer hair. They didn't look military to me.
Right.
But, of course, you know what? I had long hair and a beard, and I was a firefighter. So, you know, they generally paint. That was the kind of motif of the day in style. And I couldn't tell. They were kind of a distance away from where the car was on the soundproof road that we just traversed. And I just... I told Eileen, I said, you know, these guys are looking for something because they're walking along about 12 foot apart, walking abreast up this hillside.
So they're doing what looks like a search grid then.
Which exactly. Being in the Air Force, and particularly in Vietnam, I was assigned to several crash scene investigations, collecting evidence and so forth, and... I knew what I was looking at. It was a crash group.
Right.
You know, they were looking down at the ground. Now, I didn't see them holding any equipment like Geiger counters or or metal detectors or anything at all.
Was there any aerial surveillance that you could detect? Were there any helicopters?
None that I could see, none whatsoever.
Okay. All right.
There was no noise. At this point, we were traveling with the windows down. Now, it was early morning, so we passed a pull-off on this unapproved road where there were five or six cars that were parked there. And I could only assume that they were the POVs or private-owned vehicles of these guys that were down looking and searching along this hillside.
Gotcha.
And so I started on up this road to find a point to turn around and come back, because be quite frank and honest with you, at this point I was getting real concerned as to what I was seeing.
And
this was
the exact location
that my wife and I had thought we'd seen the UFO land or crash. And the reason I say crash is because it went barely behind a hill, a mountainside there.
Right.
And great luminescence, bright green flash, some sparks flew, things of this nature when we had last seen it. So now I was convinced that this object had artered into the ground there somewhere, and that these guys were looking for remnants of this vehicle. And so as I started up the road, this part of the road had not been lit by the sun yet, and as a consequence, there was black ice on the road, and I didn't know it.
Right.
And as I started up this road, it got about halfway up this incline to where it levels off a little bit, and probably another area to turn around at. Because the area that was there so it was occupied by these cars. There was not enough room for me to turn around. So anyway, I started up this road, and the wheels on the car started slipping. Mm-hmm. And I put the brakes on, and it started sliding backwards on this black ice.
Wow.
Because the sun had not reached this part of the mountainside yet.
Right.
In the early morning hours. And
this is October, so, you know,
yeah.
things are getting, like you said earlier, things are getting pretty cool in the evenings. And obviously it's a late morning sun before these roads are actually cleaned up and heated up. So, okay.
Absolutely.
So you're slipping, sliding backwards. You're obviously making a decision that you're going to turn around somehow.
Right. And while I couldn't get to the point where I thought I might be able to turn around, the car started sliding backwards. I tapped the brakes a few times to keep the wheels from locking up, but
right.
It didn't seem to matter. And so all I could do at this point, even put on the emergency brake, the car still was sliding, but it was progressively slowing down.
Uh-huh.
I was heading right toward these cars that were parked
right.
down there off the road. And so I'm looking in the rearview mirrors. I'm seeing that they're coming. We're coming to them, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God!" You know,
right.
Our car stops, so I don't slam into these cars, and it did start slowing down. And just before we got to the first vehicle that was parked off the road there, I noticed that I might hit it, and because the car had not actually slowed to stop yet, but
right.
It was on the verge of doing so. I did tap the fender of the car that was parked there, and I thought, oh, crap, you know. This is terrible, because now I'm going to have to talk to these people.
Right.
I was already a little bit afraid of what I was seeing at this point, and so the last thing I really wanted to do was have an interaction with these folks, and... So, anyway, I got the car kind of away from it and almost got it turned around in the road to step back down. But, like I said, I felt responsible for hitting the car. I did put a dent in the fender. And so I got out of the car and walked over to the side of the road and looked down on this incline that these gentlemen were purveying, and
right.
anyhow, I hollered down, "Hey, I just hit a car up here. I'm insured. I've got information. Please come up." And
yeah.
One of the guys broke brakes and started running up this hillside
mm-hmm.
toward our car.
Right.
And in the interim, I went ahead and got away from there and got back into the car and shut the door just as the guy came up onto the road itself, and he went right over to this car. I don't know how he knew it was his car, because
right.
you know, I didn't say he can. I just
right.
put this Pontiac or this Ford or this whatever.
Yeah.
The car itself is an old Chevrolet. It looked about a 1954 or so.
A classic car.
It was a beater.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
As we call it, an old car that was reliable wheels. So he came up and took a quick look at this small dent, maybe the size of a fist or whatever was in the fender, and then he came over, walked over to the car, right through the car door. Looked in the window, and I had rolled down, and said, "Hey, don't worry about it. It's just an old car. It's just wheels to get around for work." And he said, "Don't worry about it." I said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Here's my information. If you need it, I'm insured." And he said, "No, don't worry about it. No big deal."
Right.
And at that very moment, he turned and ran back down the hillside and back down to the area where these men had converged to
Right. And he never said why he was there or what.
No.
Never asked why you were there or anything.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, how did he know it was his car?
Right.
You know, maybe he didn't know it was his car. Maybe he just was up there to get me the heck out of there.
Right.
Is what I'm thinking. But
so what was the outcome of this then, Steve?
The altitude at this point is around 10,000 feet.
Okay.
So it's clarified. And if you don't breathe deeply up here, you can get epoxy and get terrible migraine headaches.
Right.
So anyway, when the guy turned left and went back, I looked at Eileen and said, let's get the hell out of here. She said, yes, let's do. So about halfway down this road back towards 50 Highway, I said, we'll stop and we'll span for gold for a few minutes and, stretch our legs and rest and get ready to go home. And she said, yeah, that sounds great. I'd like to pan for gold. And so I went ahead and, mind you, that I traveled over 2,500 miles at this point from my home in Kansas City to
right.
Camp Pendleton and then back. So, you know, we traveled like 2,500 miles and... this had to be, coincidentally speaking, the very spot that we had planned on stopping at, paying for gold for this incident ever occurred.
Uh-huh. Right.
So we got down about halfway. There's a pull off there. We pulled the car off the road, went down by the stream that's there. I went in, got out of the truck, I got the gold pans, and we went down to the stream and started panning for gold. Well, we hadn't even hooked for our first pan of gold of sand. We all of a sudden we heard coffee coming from down from the reservoir where we saw it. Now, I'd like to say that one of the things we did observe prior to leaving that area is we glanced across the dam at the reservoir and we noticed that there was a Ford Blazer or Ford Bronco or a Chevy Blazer. Those
right.
are about the only two SUVs at that time that were on the road.
Uh-huh.
So it had to be one of those two vehicles. And it was a white one. And the man, there was a very tall man standing there watching across the lake, across the reservoir,
right.
watching these men. And there was also a very small, petite woman standing next to him. And the only thing, like I told Eileen, so this guy is ramrod of this deal, and he's the boss, and he's standing up there observing.
Right.
And so anyway, we went on down, started doing the thing, and we heard a vehicle as we were panning for the gold by the stream come down, and it came down, not only came down, but it slowed down, and it pulled in this pull-off area that we were at with our car and went and pulled in right behind our vehicle,
right.
which was a little concerning to me
uh-huh.
at that point. I wasn't armed. At least I wasn't. I had a gun in the car, but I didn't have one on my person.
Right.
And the door came open, and lo and behold, this... very tall, white-headed gentleman got out of the SUV, and he looked down at us. We were approximately 60, 70 feet away from him, and he said, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" And I answered back, "Well, sir, we're preparing for gold."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Well, how do you do that?" Automatically, I have red flags and warning lights going off in my head going, my God,
right.
this guy's in Colorado, and he doesn't know what
and he doesn't know what
panning
for gold
about.
Is, yeah, really.
He's living in an area where gold mines have once flourished.
Mm-hmm.
My God, that really sent chills up my back. And I said, well, we have sand here in the pans, and the gold is heavier, so As you work the sand out with the water, presumably the gold flakes, which are heavier, will fall from the bottom of the pan, and that's how you collect it. He says, oh. He says, well, good luck. And then he got right back in the SUV and put his SUV in reverse, backed out onto this unimproved road, and went back up toward this area at a fairly high rate of speed for the conditions the road was in.
Right.
And as soon as he got out of sight, my wife and I looked at each other and we said, let's get the hell out of here. We were really frightened. We threw the sand back into the stream and went hands out. We didn't even put them back in the trunk. We threw them in the back seat and we got out of there PDQ.
Right. So with 9 minutes left on the show, Steve, I'm going to kind of jump you a little forward. Since that encounter, have you experienced any pains? You mentioned your shoulder. Did that reoccur over the next couple of weeks, months, years?
Well, yes. There, I felt a lump in the back of my arm, and I can only presume it's an implant.
Right.
It's still there.
Now, go ahead.
I talked to Dr. Roger Rare, who is a doctor in San Diego. He's fairly well renowned for having removed these implants to have studied. I talked with him on the telephone. I understand, by the way, I understand he's somewhat in ill health at this point in time, and I do wish him the quickest recovery. But I talked with him on the telephone to try to set up a time like get together and have the same roof. He was talking about how he wanted me to sign the rights away to this story of mine and about the encounter and et cetera, et cetera. And I told him, I said, look, buddy, I said, you know, if everybody's going to capitalize off what happened to me and my wife, it's going to be us.
Exactly.
Not some clown that I don't even know.
Yeah, I was born at night, but not last night, pal. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Now, have you been involved with any regressive hypnosis? Has anybody?
Yes, I have.
And were there any indications that you were aboard this craft, or that something had happened? Yes.
Yes, there was. A couple of years later, coincidentally speaking, I happened to be a musician on the side. I was a firefighter. I had a band, and on my days off, I would work with a band around the area locally. And a musician that I knew, Chris Edwards, lived close by, and I happened to be at his house one day kind of talking about this. I had never really told him about it. And I was talking to him about it, and he says, and I told him about, I thought about getting some hypnotherapy or regressive hypnosis in regard to this incident. And he said, well, gosh, you ought to go see my dad. I said, well, who's your dad? And he says, his name is Dr. Fowler Jones. He's the head of the clinical psychiatrist, head of the department at the Kansas University Medical Center. And I thought, wow, talk about coincidence. So I did schedule an appointment with Dr. Jones. By the way, Dr. Tyler Jones, at that point, was a protege and had learned these regressive hypnosis techniques from Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who was one of the first men in ufology to do that. He's the guy, I believe, I'm not sure, but I think he might have been the fellow that regressed Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh, yeah.
But anyhow, so he had some training, he was a protege of Dr. Sprinkles. And so I went there, and I had a total of four hypnosis sessions with him. Now, I'm going to say right off the bat, okay, in 1979, Stanford University did a study. It was conclusive, and it was a study of two control groups, one consisting of college students attending there and the other was of a group, patrol group of people who had allegedly had UFO encounters. Both groups were tested, regressed, and the findings were that both groups, including the student group of students that evidently had supposedly never been under this kind of an encounter before, had under hypnosis described pretty much the same thing that the group of alleged abductees had described. So I wasn't too thrilled about it. At that point, I had read several UFO books. I didn't know if my mind had been tainted by what I had read or anything else. So I went into it with open eyes and an open mind. However, under hypnosis, and I, by the way, I taped those sessions, and is one of the things I required before I would consent to being taken under regressive hypnosis. And so anyway, during these sessions, I recanted a story of the car being actually physically lifted up off the road by this intense white light, which, you know, at the time felt like not just so light, but it really felt like something of mass had enveloped the car. And so in my account under hypnosis, I recalled the car being lifted up into the air into a large cylindrical object and placed in a bay there on aboard this object. It was a small area enough to accommodate a car and width-wise and length-wise, probably about 3 car lengths. And so as we sat there, three beings came out of the wall, it appeared like, at the time, and came down a ramp toward the car in lockstep, like to marching down or something of this nature.
Right.
And under hypnosis, I recalled them telling me to unlock the car door. The funny thing is the mouths weren't moving. The mouths are very small. They look like what has been described as grays, except they were about the same height, a large cranial fan. They were spindly, had spindly arms and legs, very much looking like what had been described in some of the books I read about aliens as grays. However, they didn't have those dark, almond-shaped eyes, black eyes. They had large eyes, but these eyes actually have pupils in them in white part of the eye. They look like pretty much like regular eyes, except larger. And they put me inside. They floated me inside, two of them, and one marching behind us. Two of them actually lifted me up and in a reclined position being taken. I felt immobilized at that point, like I couldn't really do anything about it. I was taken into an area. I was asked, again, telepathically, I believe, the same way that they had told me to unlock the car door, telepathically, and they told me to sit on this small kind of a table. And one of these beings stood there in front of me, just kind of watching me. I guess its job was to keep an eye on me, make sure I didn't go anywhere.
Right.
So people, like I said, at that time, I was completely immobilized, and I couldn't have done anything anyhow. And they took me into a room. They put me on a table. They examined me.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I, like I said, I couldn't tell for sure because I could only move my eyes back and forth from the right to the left.
Right.
I was not up or down, and One of the things I remember is a sharp pain in the back of my left arm, which must have been at the time they implanted the implant in my left arm. And that's all I remember. And all I could recall under regressive hypnosis, the next thing I knew, we were, car was coming down and landing back on the highway, only 10 miles further, you know, than where we had just seemed to be just moments before.
Exactly. Now, hold on to that thought, Steve. This is a very unusual situation. To our stations down the road, we told you we were taking you 30 minutes over. We're going to take you another 30 minutes because we can't let this story go. Hang in there, Steve. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Let's do a station break. For all of the stations down the line that do have to leave us, you will be able to pick this up on the archive. For those of you that are staying with us, hang in there.
Looking to email the show?
KTR@nighttalkradio.com
or come to our blog, nighttalkradio.com. Phone lines are open 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
NightTalkRadio.com.
Phone lines are open 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
Comments and statements made by tonight's host or guests remain the opinion of the speaker and not necessarily the opinion of Night Talk Radio or the Terror Chat Network.
Purveyor of Paranormal Pontification, Colin Knight.
And we are with Steve Nance tonight, first person abductee paranormal experience. So, Steve, let's go back to while you're on board this craft and you're sitting on this table, and you believe they injected you with some kind of a device into your left arm.
Yes, I was lying on the table, actually.
Right.
And fully reclined on the table. And two things happened that I can recall. There were very small rods that were placed into my index fingers, one in each hand.
Okay.
And that plus the sharp pain I felt in the back of my arm were the really only two things I could recall under regressive hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to also say that there's a lot of corroborating evidence that made it impossible for me to write this off as a mass hallucination or, an illusion,
right,
or hallucination of any kind. And one of the things, of course, the first thing was the corroboration by the police officers that I encountered in Slider, Colorado, saying, "Hey, welcome to the club. You know, it's been going on for the last 2 or 3 weeks. It's been in the national news, blah, blah, blah." And so, when my wife and I left, we went to go back on our trip to Kansas City, during in western Kansas, not a whole lot to do or see. So we talked fairly extensively about what had happened to us in Colorado.
Right.
And we had decided that we weren't going to tell anybody. I didn't want to tell anybody because I was a firefighter, lead hoseman, and
right.
there were men's lives who depended upon me. And I certainly didn't want them thinking I'd gone off my rocker and was talking about UFOs or something, because I didn't even believe in UFOs before this happened.
Right.
I was just a nuts and bolts guy. I worked on some of the most sophisticated aircraft in the arsenal, including the field trial of the F-111 fighter bomber while I was stationed in Vietnam. I came to hold the base for what I was doing there. But I tell you, I was working around some of the most sophisticated aircraft in the Air Force inventory. And
right.
So anyway,
you're a no-nonsense, matter-of-fact kind of guy that doesn't take what's happened to him lightly. And, of course, in 77, UFOs and the knowledge of UFOs weren't accepted as much as they are in today's society. So you wanted to keep quiet. You didn't want to push the envelope and have to go through all kinds of ridicule. You know, firefighters, they're men's men, you know, tough as they come, hard as boots. I could see why you wouldn't want to say anything. Now, when you were discussing this with Eileen, did she also have regressive therapy? Did she remember anything?
No, she didn't. And the odd part about this is that she did not have, because I became obsessed.
Right.
And she did not seem to have this obsession that I possessed. And as a matter of fact, when I was taken out of the car by these three creatures, the way they floated me, I was able to kind of, when I was standing vertical or was vertical, I don't know if I was standing, like I said,
I
wasn't feeling much of anything, but I happened to look at my wife, and she was just standing, sitting there with a blank stare on her face, not moving at all, and so I believe I was the only one that was actually examined or taken elsewhere from the car.
Right.
And so she didn't seem to have that same drive that I had to find out what had happened to that missing time and distance. And so anyway, we got back to Kansas City. We developed the several rolls of film that we had taken on our vacation out in California to show my mom.
Right.
We got him back for the processor. We took him over to my mom's house, and we were looking through these photos. My sister came at that point in time while we were looking at the photos and came in the house. And the first thing she said to us was, how was your vacation or anything like that?
Right.
It was, hey, did you see Big Mother when you came through Colorado?
Yeah.
And I said, Big Mother? What the hell was that? You know, is that a new amusement ride in Denver? What is that? She said, no, no, it's a UFO they've been seeing all over the state of Colorado for almost the last month.
It's oh, my
Lord. The national news and this and that and another thing. And she said, well, just tomorrow I'll get the article from the Denver Post out in the car. I'll bring it in. Well, she went out of the car, retrieved the article, and brought it in, which also included a photograph by Jack Pratt, and lo and behold, it was a very object that my wife and I had encountered. The
donut-shaped,
large industry player-looking object. My sister and my mother and my wife later told me that after I saw that, I just turned gray.
Wow.
And I went because right there it hit me that something had really happened to us. That had just pretty much nailed it down at that point. And so anyway, as we were going through the photographs after that, I happened to notice that the guy that took blanks and came up to the car after I smacked the automobile accidentally. My wife had snapped a picture of this guy. I always kept my 35mm Minolta, which was an XG1, which had automatic shutter release on it, magnetic shutter release, and of course, you know, it was in the back seat at all times. Uh-huh. It was even in the back seat when this occurred, but my God, you know, at 10 to 12 seconds, you're scared out of your wits, and
so,
you're not thinking about taking a picture of anything.
Exactly. So did this guy look any different than your average Joe that you would meet on the street? Was there anything different about him?
No, there really wasn't.
No.
He was in civilian clothing, dungarees, and a work shirt of some kind. He had a white helmet on, which I still can't understand why all these guys had white helmets on. I mean, hell, they wouldn't have fallen from the sky. They weren't in a work safety zone or anything of this nature.
Right.
So I don't really know what that was all about, and I still don't. But sure enough, we've got a picture of the guy. I still have the negatives, by the way. I will release them when I complete the book that I'm writing in regard to this whole adventure.
Right.
And
I'm sure Ed Fleming will guide you through that process of validating and authenticating for you, Steve, to make sure that the information stays true. Ed is a very, very much a professional when it comes to the work that he does with FTTO UFO. They're a fabulous organization. I've dealt with them on a number of occasions, and I gotta give you, I can't say enough good things about the organization that he's associated with, and you're definitely in good hands. So, since this event, 35 years.
Yeah.
How has your health been, sir?
Well, I got wounded in Vietnam, so I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and that has always given me a problem. But since this encounter, I have contracted severe rheumatoid arthritis as well.
Okay.
And I can't really say it's as a result of this encounter, but I will say that it has come on me since that encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1988, I was diagnosed with severe rheumatoid arthritis. Since then, I've been taking all kinds of exotic medications, methotrexate, flutamides, Percocets for pain, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not in the best of health. I wear a back brace a lot. But you know what? I'm breathing.
Yeah.
and
you're
still mobile.
And you're definitely firing on all cylinders. So
exactly.
You know, and so that in itself, that is an amazing accomplishment. Now the wound in Vietnam, Steve, very serious.
Well, I had it was in the line of duty and in a war zone, but it was not as a result of hostile action. We had some planes, F-4s, which I worked on there, McDonnell F-4Cs, Phantoms, and we had equipment that were pods. It was ECM equipment that we hung on the aircraft center line, and it was used to, when they went up north of the DMZ, to ward off SAM missiles and MiGs.
Okay.
So
like a chaff system.
Yeah, it was about 350 pounds worth of hardware.
Right.
Contained in a pod. I can't really say more than that because this equipment is still being used on the F-4, and the F-4 is in the inventory of many of the air forces around the world still.
Right.
So I can't really divulge or discuss.
And we can accept that it was heavy, and this caused your injury.
Well, I was helping to unload one off a cradle that we had set up and calibrated in the shop. I was getting ready to put it onto a transporter and take it up the flight line to hang out on the aircraft.
Right.
They were already late for a mission. It was a rush deal. However, the guy there was a guy operating the hydraulics on this crane that lifted this object up and put it onto the vehicle to take out the flight line. But the hydraulics on it failed. And it was the only one we had calibrated sitting in the shop, so I didn't want to let it fall to the ground. So me and another guy, there were two of us, one on one end and one on the other, and when I saw the hydraulics starting to go and the thing starting to lower, we couldn't possibly let it hit the ground. If it did, it would have messed it up. We couldn't have used it. Like I said, these planes were not only fueled up and fired up, they were sitting on the revetment with pilots in them and ready to go on a mission.
Right.
So what happened is when the hydraulics came down, the guy on one end of it let go of it. I slid to the middle of it, and I held it there until they could get a card underneath it. When I did that, I could feel something pop in my lower back.
Right.
And as it turns out, it ruptured a disc in my lower back.
Gotcha.
And it sent a bone spur into my spinal cord. That's the reason they have never operated on it, because they said they operated on it when I got home from Vietnam and I was military. Went to the VA, they said if they operated on it, chances are 50-50 that I'd never walk again.
Well, you'd be paralyzed, yeah.
I thought those were pretty bad odds.
Yeah.
So it was an elective surgery, and I rejected it. I'm glad I did, because I'm just getting ready to turn 66 here in a couple of days. And,
God bless
you. You know, for an old guy, I get around pretty good shape for an old couple guy.
So, Steve, let's take you back to Colorado, that incident in itself. When you were in this room and you felt that you were frozen, so to speak, that you couldn't move, did you smell anything or hear anything other than the words coming from these people that are not speaking? Did you smell anything at all?
Well, you know, it's funny that, what did you say just a while ago, something cold or something like that? The funny thing is, Colin, that after each one of these regressive sessions, I would have this terrible urge, because I felt extremely cold, it would happen during these regressive sessions, and I would have to urinate really bad. And so much so that by the second session, I decided that morning I wasn't even going to drink any coffee or anything, so I wouldn't be in that position again. But shows the world, the remaining three sessions that I went through, at the end of each one of them, I had this terrific urge to urinate because I felt like I'd been so cold.
Uh-huh.
And, really, if you stop and think about it, the only thing I felt that was close to that was when I had open heart surgery in 2005, and the operating theater that they put me in to replace a heart valve was super cold. And the first thing that hit me was, oh my God, you know, no wonder the place was cold, because they were doing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
They were keeping it cold to try to keep any disease or whatnot from the patient.
Right. Did you during this time that you were in this frozen state, so to speak, did you smell anything in that room at all, Steve? Were there anything different than in your normal life?
No. The only thing that I noticed, not only in the operating theater itself or the area where they're examining me, was that the bay that the car ended up in, and the room that they took me to wait before I went into this examination area was all wet by a light that I couldn't see. The light was everywhere. The luminosity was fairly even, but I could never see a place where there was a light bulb or a light source or anything of this nature. That kind of confused and bewildered me. Anyway, that's really all I remember from my regression was the coldness of this area, the lights, just coming from seemingly everywhere, but no light source indicated. And the two metal rods, thin rods, were placed in the ends of my index fingers, and the sharp pain I felt at one point in the back of my left arm. Again, I can only imagine it was them implanting, putting the implant in. So outside of that, no, I don't recall any odors that I can remember or anything of this nature.
Right. Now, these rods that they put into the fingers, Steve, did you, after it was over and your back of the truck stop and the likes, did you have any puncture wounds on your fingers that you noticed? Was there any change?
Yes, I did, but they weren't sore, and as a matter of fact, you got to look real hard to see the scars now that they've healed up pretty much, but at the time, I did have a couple of indentations in the ends of my index fingers,
right.
And so, you know, to me, that kind of said, well, maybe that really did happen, you know,
uh-huh.
the way I talked about it under hypnosis.
Right.
And so forth. But outside of that, no, there wasn't even any scarring or anything in the area in the back of my left arm where the implant still sits.
Right. So to sum this up, Steve, in the last 35 years or so, what do you think was the reasoning for what they did? Was it just experimentation? Do you think they singled you out, or were you just an abductee of opportunity?
Well, here's the long and short of it, Colin, and that mm-hmm. is that I believe, especially with evidence 1989 of a video produced by a local there in Salida, Colorado itself, mm-hmm. of a video showing a mothership-type object with smaller UFOs, donut-shaped UFOs, by the way, coming to and from them at terrific speeds. I'm going to tell you this, and it may be shocking to you and to your listeners, but I have this to say about it, that we are being abducted 24/7, and it's been going on for the longest time, maybe even before recorded history.
Okay.
There are millions, literally millions of people on this planet that have gone through this process, many of them unwittingly and unknowingly. I just happened to be one of the guys that, one of the people that caused this thing happening to them,
mm-hmm.
and I would say this, that this is a worldwide situation. These entities, whatever they are, who the hell knows what their agendas are, what their mission is, their agendas are hidden, they act in covertness, they act in a clandestine manner, they have kept their kids out of the safety and sanctity of their own houses.
Right.
My brother and I did find out during depression that I did recount that my brother and I had been taken when we were kids.
Okay.
My brother now realized my brother had these terrible nocturnal nosebleeds, and I used to have horrible migraine headaches every time I'd have this reoccurring nightmare of this abduction scenario. And I believe that we actually were taken at that time, and this reoccurring nightmare was an actual account in my mind of
right.
what had truly happened to me at one point.
Right. So do you think that they had an agenda, or were they just looking at the human species in general? Do you think that...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
There's no answer,
is there? I mean, you know, who knows? They're not telling us what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, I've been studying this stuff for 35 years. I've come no closer to finding out what the hell happened to me than I did the very morning I saw this thing fly up a canyon and auger into a mountainside.
Right.
So, no, we don't know. It's all pure speculation at this juncture. It's all pure speculation. And, you know, nobody knows anymore than we knew when Stanton Friedman did his piece on the Roswell incident.
Exactly.
You know, so it's very perplexing. It's very, it is, to me, it has become the ultimate exercise in futility. It really has, It's
no doubt.
Impressive as hell, believe me.
Yeah, I can believe it. When you, especially for a trained investigator that cannot get to the answer. I can relate to that, Steve. Steve, let me just sum this up by saying, sir, thank you for your service. It is loyal and trusted Americans such as yourself that keeps North America safe. And without you, God only knows where we would be today. And I appreciate it, and I'm sure my listeners appreciate your service. And I wish you Godspeed, Steve, and hopefully everything will be all right in your life and that you will live many, many more years. And happy birthday whenever it's coming up in the next little while. And
thank you very much.
You hoist one for me, my friend, from one military brat to another. We definitely appreciate you out there. I'm looking forward to seeing what Ed Fleming has to produce for you. And we are gonna have you back, Steve. I absolutely guarantee you on that. So
thank you, because you know I'd like to talk about some of the things that I've been investigating with Mar. Again, that's at you can find that at www.maarmar.us. www.maarmar.us is my website. You can contact me anytime, Colin. I'd be pleased to come back and discuss some of these things with you at further length.
Fabulous, fabulous. Thank you very much, Steve. You take care of yourself. Thank you for your patience and allowing me to hold you 2 hours instead of the registered 1 hour. We do appreciate it. God bless, Godspeed, and blessings on your household, sir.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Good night, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Nance, multi-level UFO investigator. He's had first-person experience. He's in the process of putting together a book with the assistance of Mr. Ed Fleming from FTTO UFO, a fabulous organization that brings these paranormal and first-person contacts to the front and foremost information. And we do appreciate Ed and the gang being out there and that they have chosen to help Steve get through this and put it to paper. And I'm most certainly looking forward to being able to read this story in total. And we will have Steve back at another time. Night Talk Radio, we had planned for 1 hour tonight. We've gone 2 hours, and I dare say we could have gone 3 hours. But I think that would have been just a little too much information for tonight. We will have Steve back, and we will fill in the gaps, especially with his website, www.maar.us. Make sure you go over there and say your kudos to Steve. Let him know you heard him on Night Talk Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madame and messieurs, that's it. That's all. My name is Colin Knight. I will be back tomorrow night on VOCR, the Voice of the Canadian Rockies, and we're going to be looking at politics. Yep. We're going to have a look at the Romney-Ryan complaint, and we're going to have a look at Barack Hussein Obama and see how those guys are getting along. Until then, in the meantime, in between time, that's it, that's all. Another edition of Night Talk Radio. You be safe out there.
Hey there, got a minute? We all have busy lives, and sometimes we forget the small things in life that make many people happy. We work hard, we earn a great deal of money, or we hope to, and we spend a great deal of money. And yet there are those in our world who have no money to spend. There are those in this world that are fighting for survival as we speak. Give a moment to think of those people. Do what you can as a good human being. Do what you can to help their world be a little brighter. Good night, and we'll catch you back here on the next edition.
This has been a TerraChat Network production. www.terrachatnet.com.